Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After nearly 2 years as a hostage, American journalist Peter Theo Curtis has been released by an Al-Qaeda affiliate. When he arrived back in his hometown of Boston this week, he spoke to reporters.
I'm also overwhelmed by one other thing, and that is that total strangers have been coming up to me and saying, "Hey, we're just glad you're home. Welcome home. Glad you're back. Glad you're safe. Great to see you." So I suddenly remember how good the American people are and what kindness they have in their hearts.
Curtis's release, however, comes on the heels of the tragic death of journalist James Foley, who was beheaded by ISIS militants in Syria. And his release aside, the deliberate targeting of foreign journalists has escalated in recent years. According to the Committee for the Protection of Journalists, 32 reporters from around the world have been killed so far in 2014. Coming up, we'll hear from a veteran foreign correspondent who's reported from 96 countries over the course of his career. Joining us now by phone is New York Times' Rukmini Kalamaki. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
You've been covering the Curtis story. Do we know the circumstances around his initial capture 2 years ago?
His initial capture remains very shadowy, and we're waiting for Theo to tell his own story. All we know is that he was in Turkey in a border area, and his mother received a last email from him in October 2012. She became panicked very quickly. In a couple of days, she just felt in her heart that something was wrong, but it wasn't. It was. A very long while after that we knew that he was in the captivity of the Nusra Front. We only learned this in July of 2013, some 9 months later, after one of his cellmates managed to escape and came out and told the world what had happened.
So what do we know about his captors in Syria? It's an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Is it Jabhat al-Nusra?
That's right. It's Jabhat al-Nusra, or also called Nusra Front.
And tell us about them.
They're the official branch of Al-Qaeda in Syria. Up until recently, they and ISIS were the same group. They then split, and in a great irony for those of us who cover Al-Qaeda, ISIS is even more brutal, even more extreme than Al-Qaeda. So Nusra Front, compared to them, starts to look like a moderate organization.
But they captured him 2 years ago, so they've been sort of operating under the radar here?
They captured him. It's not completely clear who held him in the first months of his captivity. What's clear is that at a certain point they had him, and interlocutors for this group made a series of demands to the family. They started with a ransom of $3 million, and then when they saw that European hostages being held by ISIS were being released for large ransom amounts, they ended up increasing their demand up to $25 million, which of course the family could not pay. They also, through an intermediary, asked for a very complicated prisoner swap, which of course the family could not pull off. And really, he was only released once Qatar became involved in the negotiation. Qatar has been a country that has helped in previous cases of Al-Qaeda kidnappings in Yemen, where a lot of Europeans have been taken. And in those instances, we know that they paid a ransom to AQAP, the branch in Yemen. It's still unclear what the quid pro quo was for the release of Theo Curtis.
Okay. And it feels unusual that he was released. Americans, typically, is that what happens, or are they made more an example of, such as with the other correspondent?
Yes. What the case for Americans is usually quite dire. Americans, on the one hand, tend to be kidnapped less, along with British citizens, because our countries have both Britain and America have a very hard line on not paying ransoms and on not making any concessions to terrorist groups. By contrast, other European countries, especially France and Spain, they also say the same thing, but in fact they do pay ransoms. And so there's been a lot more Europeans that have been taken than Americans and Brits. However, once an American or a British citizen is taken, and especially if they're being held alongside Europeans, they're at a much higher danger of being executed because their captors see no other value in them if they're not going to get money for them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Rukmini Kalamaki. She's a reporter for The New York Times. We're talking about the release of American journalist Peter Theo Curtis and how that contrasts with the recent execution of another American journalist, James Foley, who was beheaded by ISIS militants in Syria. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. So we don't know exactly the circumstances of his release, of Curtis's release, but you're saying Qatar has been involved in recent years in hostage negotiations. How did Qatar come to be such a powerful negotiator?
Qatar has, in the past, been accused of financing Al-Qaeda groups. So they have a conduit to these groups. They're also a small and very rich Gulf nation. They're rich with oil, and I think that they're trying to become an important player on the world stage. I think the Theo Curtis negotiation came at an apropos time. Qatar is under a lot of scrutiny right now, specifically because they're accused of having financed the groups in Syria, and they're also accused of having financed Hamas. So you could say that this was a good time for them to have a PR victory, and I think the PR victory was complete. We now see Theo's incredibly, incredibly thankful parents who went on air to thank them at a time when you could say that their stock was down.
James Foley's captors demanded a ransom, as you said. So did Theo Curtis's. We have a clip of him pleading for help on July 18th. Let's listen.
My life is in very, very, very grave danger. I have 3 days. They're giving me 3 days to live. 3 days. If you don't do anything, I'm finished. I'm dead. They will kill me.
Now, Theo Curtis is not talking to the media yet, or hasn't publicly, about his experience, but others have gone before him. What's happening in a clip like that? What are we hearing him do? Besides the obvious, of course.
Right. So what happened in June of this year is that the Nusra Front announced a deadline to kill him, which is what they typically do when they've made a ransom demand and the negotiations have stalled. So he's now 3 days from that deadline, and he's being recorded. You know, the poor man is being recorded saying that I have 3 days to live. The purpose of that is obviously to put pressure on the family and to put pressure on the U.S. government. I think that James Foley's horrific death might have played a role in his release, because of course the world was enraged by that, and it created much more of an urgency for Qatar and the other go-betweens to successfully negotiate his release.
These takings of hostages, that's been very profitable for groups like Nusra. Do we have any idea how much money's going out typically with these?
What we know from James Foley's family, who also waited 2 years, before their child was killed, is that they themselves came to the realization that they would need to aim for $5 million as the benchmark for the ransom. And they determined this from knowing what other European hostages who were held with Jim Foley, what those countries and those entities paid. So I think for Nusra Front and for Syria, that seems to be the average, perhaps a little bit less. I also heard from hostages in Europe that two million euros, which is a little bit less than that, was also being paid. An investigation that I did earlier this year indicated that for the Al-Qaeda network, which does not include ISIS, that at least $125 million has been paid to the group just in the past 5 years, almost all of it to free Europeans and most of it paid by European countries.
How do the policy stances of the United States and, say, contrast with those of France in deciding whether or not to deal with these groups?
You know, on the face of it, their policies are the same. Both France and the United States say that they don't pay ransoms. Mm-hmm. And it took me a lot of digging and really a lot of source work in Africa, specifically through the negotiators who were involved in the exchanges, to finally determine that that indeed, on one side of the Atlantic, they say they don't pay and they really don't pay. And on the other, they say they don't pay, but then through intermediaries, they end up doing so. And I think what's happened in Europe is that the trend started in 2003 when Germany paid a ransom of around $5 million to release, I'm sorry, 5 million euros, I believe, to release 32 Europeans who were being held by an Islamist group in Algeria and Mali. And that set the stage. Once you've done it once, it becomes very hard to not do it the second time. And I know that President François Hollande, who came to office a few years ago, he tried very hard, I think, to stop the ransom paying business. But he ended up coming in on one side of an uncompleted kidnapping ransom exchange. There were seven French and other nationals who were taken from a French-owned company in Niger. And before he came to office, three of them were released, so their families were, of course, relieved. He comes to office, there were still four being held. And when he tried to stop paying the ransoms, I know from speaking to those who are close to the family, obviously the families revolted. You know, how is it that three of our relatives get out, and then you come to office and you decide to stop this, and suddenly we stop? If you stop paying, it obviously means that those people will be killed. And so it's a very hard price for a politician to pay.
But has the paying of the ransoms, is there any connection between that and the proliferation of the kidnappings?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we have plenty of evidence to suggest that that these terror groups, especially in Africa and perhaps in Yemen as well, are trolling and looking for particular nationalities. The French and the Spanish seem to be the most prolific payers, and I did an interview with an Italian woman who was taken in 2011. She was grabbed from a campsite in southern Algeria, and when they grabbed her, her captors were screaming at her, "Where are the French tourists?" And she said, I'm alone. I'm just an Italian woman. Where are the French tourists?" So they were clearly looking for French people.
And when they pay the ransom, where does the money come from? Does it come from the coffers of the government, or are there organizations that pitch in?
In most of the cases, it seems to come from public funds, and they're funneled through a very complicated network of proxies. For instance, when Germany paid the ransom for the 32 people, this was back in 2003, German officials carried the suitcases of cash to Mali, which is where the hostages had been transferred to. They gave those suitcases of cash to the Malian president, and they wrote it off as humanitarian aid, which is not hard to believe because Germany had a longstanding relationship with this African country and was, you know, doing development projects there. Then the Malian president, arranged for that money to be sent up to the people who were holding the Europeans, and they were released.
Has this increase in kidnappings affected the ranks of foreign journalists covering the conflicts overseas?
Absolutely. I mean, especially in the Syrian conflict, it seems that a preponderance of the hostages who were grabbed and who are still being held now were reporters. And beyond that, they're freelance reporters. That means that they don't have the backing of a large news organization behind them, mm-hmm. Which early on, in 2013, many kind of legacy news organizations realized that there was an enormous risk in sending staffers there, and so we started to pull back. I feel very sorry for these freelance reporters because I was a freelancer myself when I started out, and mm-hmm. I know what it's like. It's very hard to get your start in this competitive environment, and so you try to go to the places where a news organization doesn't have a staff member in the hopes of being able to sell your story.
Now, do the large new organizations, though, also when they do send somebody, they give them better security, right? Or not necessarily?
It's not quite what you think. I mean, I don't. I before joining the Times, I was at the Associated Press, and we certainly in Africa we didn't have a security detail that was flanking us. What you do have is most large news organizations have a security advisor, and there's a very strict protocol of how you check in with that person and having discussions with that person about what you plan to do, and that creates a certain framework. It doesn't necessarily, save you each time, but at least you're having a discussion about the decisions you're making on a daily basis. Sometimes, for me, when I was in northern Mali, I was sometimes talking to this person twice a day. And the freelancers, by contrast, are talking just to other reporters and trying their best to make decisions, and sometimes making very bad choices.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Rukmini Kalimaki. She's a reporter for the New York Times. Coming up, we're going to hear from veteran foreign correspondent David Greenway. He's the author of a new book. It's called Foreign Correspondent, a Memoir. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Most journalists spend their time reporting on the fascinating things other people do. It's usually about standing on the outside looking in. And then there are war correspondents, those reporters on the battlefields who don bulletproof vests and carry sidearms along with their notebooks. David Greenway's nearly 40-year career has taken him to almost 100 countries, from Vietnam to Afghanistan. His new book is called Foreign Correspondent, a Memoir. He joins us by phone from Maine. David Greenway, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We were just talking to a New York Times reporter about recent tragedies and abductions of foreign journalists, and reading your book, you know, I wanted to follow up with you on that, about the contrast and what difference it does make when you do have a big organization behind you, as you often did, at least later in your career.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with what your previous guest said. And when I landed in Baghdad in 2005, I was working for the Boston Globe, but the New York Times, which owned the Globe in those days, met me at the airport with an armored Mercedes with bulletproof glass and several Iraqis, and a car to follow us filled with armed Iraqis. The trunk was full of machine guns. And we drove into town. In those days, that airport road was a death trap, and so I felt a lot safer with this armed escort riding into town. If you're a freelancer without any support and no one's looking after you, in those days, you could be kidnapped before you even got into town. And so I think that without an organization behind you, it's very, very difficult and very, very dangerous.
What sort of camaraderie is there among journalists in a situation like that?
Oh, I think there's enormous camaraderie between the journalists. They all help each other out and give each other advice, and it doesn't matter whether you're competing or not. We sort of take the attitude, let our editors compete. We're going to keep each other informed. So I think that's a big part of it, and very useful, because when you arrive in a new place and your colleagues have been there, some of them for years, and they can take you aside and say, look, here are things that you can do and what you can't do. For example, in Cambodia during the fight with the Khmer Rouge years and years ago, you learned that if you were driving on a road and there was no traffic for several minutes coming the other way, you turned around and went back, because it meant that the road had been cut and that the Khmer Rouge were waiting on the road to kidnap you and kill you. With the Khmer Rouge, they didn't ask for ransom. They just killed you. No reporter who ever got caught by them ever got back alive. And so you learn these little techniques and rules of the road, if you will. For example, were you to come into a village, children would always gather around you, curious to see a foreigner and crowding around you. And if there were no children in the village and no one was crowding around you, it meant that they or their parents were afraid that the Khmer Rouge might be nearby. So you just got out of the village as quietly and as quickly as you can and left. So reporters learn these little, every war, every town really has its own, well, every war has its own list of things to do to try to lessen the odds that you'll be captured or killed. But it's a dangerous business, and all the support in the world isn't going to help you if somebody just comes up and shoots you.
When you started your career, when you talk about the Khmer Rouge, obviously it was just as dangerous then as it is now. Or were there differences? Is there some kind of sense that the world's a scarier place now, or is journalism different?
I think journalism, this kind of reporting, has always been dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I think that what makes it more dangerous in Syria is that nobody likes you. You're not on anybody's side. And so therefore, at least in Cambodia, if you were with Cambodian government troops, they were permitting you to be there and they weren't going to hurt you. But with this war, the Assad government's not on your side, certainly the Islamists aren't on your side. So it's extremely dangerous and difficult to cover.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with veteran foreign correspondent David Greenway. He's the author of a new book. It's called Foreign Correspondent, a Memoir. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was thinking about it when they were talking about Theo Curtis and the fact that his mother hadn't heard from him, hadn't gotten a text from him in a few days, and that's when she knew something was up. How maybe things have changed in terms of that sort of communication ability. When you might or someone might go missing during the Cambodian War, how long might it be before anyone knew you were gone in the first place?
Well, people would know it if you just didn't show up. I mean,
so you were still making arrangements with people and letting them know when you were supposed to be back.
Yeah, it would take longer because there were no cell phones back in those days, mm-hmm. and the telephones to America didn't work. So we corresponded through the post office telegraph system, which cranked out its signal from Phnom Penh to Manila and then to New York or wherever. So, yeah, it was slower. It was slower.
I always wonder why people get into the business of journalism that they do. You know, I got into it 30 years ago and had my set of goals, and I wondered about yours, and you did write about them. You said you were traveling overseas during a break from school in 1956, parted company with your travel companions in order to visit Cairo, point being that there was trouble over there over the nationalization of the Suez Canal. And in other words, you ran toward the conflict. This is when you were still in school. You weren't a journalist yet. Where do you think that proclivity comes from? Do you find kindred spirits out there with you covering these conflicts and wars?
Well, as I said, the camaraderie between the reporters is very high, mm-hmm. but if you're curious about things, Harrison Salisbury, the great New York Times reporter, once said that journalism gives shy people a chance to ask questions. And if you're curious and interested in foreign affairs, you would certainly head for Cairo in 56 to see what was going on.
But you weren't a journalist at the time, right?
No, I wasn't, and I didn't even have it in the back of my mind. Mm. But it was irresistible to go there with this world crisis and find out, have a look at it.
I heard another person, a journalist, once describe the job of a journalist is to ask the quintessential question, who are you? How do you live your life? You know, those kinds of questions about a people. And when you're covering war, how much do you feel like you really get to know the people of a country?
Well, it very much depends. You're not covering the war all the time, and you do get to know people and hear their stories because you're not interviewing just stories. I mean, a big part of war is the civilians who get caught up in it. And so you're always talking to see how people's lives are, how they're managing. Refugees, wars produce streams and hundreds of thousands of refugees. And that's a story, too, how they're being how they're being taken care of and how they're getting on with their lives. And through that, you do get to know a country. The longer you stay there, the better you get to know it, of course. And let me put in a good word, which is, I think, very much underestimated. The local journalists who are hired, or you hire, to translate for you, to or ease the way with the bureaucracy and get your press permits and all these kind of things, they are the unsung heroes. They do a tremendous job. None of us could work abroad, overseas, in a dangerous situation without them. And yet, they never appear in the stories, or very seldom, and they don't get the credit they so richly deserved. I think the most famous of all was Deeth Prahn, who worked with Sidney Shanberg of the New York Times and was the subject of that old movie, The Killing Fields. And that was the only film I've ever seen that pointed out what a great job and how necessary these local hires are.
And what a great risk they're taking.
Yes, what risk they're taking. They're like, I always thought of them as like big game hunters. They have rich clients or not so rich clients who are likely to get them into trouble, but their job is to deliver the big game of the story and keep their clients out of trouble. And it's dangerous work.
And they often are journalists. They're not just hired hands to work through bureaucracy. They're often journalists, too?
Often journalists, yes. Often journalists who, because of the disruption in their own countries, don't have the work that they might have once had. And so they go to work for newspapers and television and radio. And without them, the American and European correspondents couldn't get on.
David in Columbus, you're on the air with David Greenway, author of Foreign Correspondent, a memoir. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a quick question. I was in Vietnam era military, and in every war there's problems, atrocities, crimes. I just wonder how often these are getting out compared to Vietnam era.
I don't know. Yes, I agree completely. There are always atrocities with every war. And I've read about some of them in Iraq and Afghanistan. You read where some poor American GI has lost his head and goes out shooting people on the street. You know, it does happen. But whether it's reported more or less, I just don't know.
Thanks for that call, David. The first war you reported on was Vietnam. Did you feel differently about the conflict before you went over there and started reporting? And how do you, if you do maintain your objectivity, which I'm sure you, that's what we're trained to do and work to do, is that, how do you do it in a wartime situation?
Well, when I first went to Vietnam, I thought this is an absolutely necessary thing to do. We had to turn back communism, and we couldn't let them take over Southeast Asia. But as time, when I got there and time wore on, I began to see that the story was much more complicated, and what the Vietnamese that we were fighting cared more about nationalism and reuniting their country and getting rid of colonialism was more important to them than communism. So there was an evolving thought process there.
Yeah, you wrote that America, and you've said it before, isn't very good at colonizing other countries.
No, I don't think that's what we are good at, and I think usually when we've tried, it hasn't worked out very well.
a lot of times we don't hear about it. It was interesting to hear Theo Curtis say to the reporters later on in that clip that we heard from earlier in the show that he really just wanted to start bonding with his family and get back to his family and wasn't going to go into a lot of detail about his experience.
Well, and you can't blame him, can you?
Absolutely not. It's completely understandable. But I wondered how your job over the years has affected your relationship with your family, the time you got to spend with your kids, that sort of thing, and how you kind of decompressed, how you did that.
Well, I think it's difficult for families. And when I was in Vietnam, for example, my family lived in Hong Kong because it wasn't thought safe to live in Vietnam. And but from time to time, I was given time off and could go back to see them. And we had a pretty strong family. And the reunions were all the sweeter for the separations.
Mm-hmm. But then you would return.
Yes, that's right. And my wife was a very cool and capable person. For example, when I was shot in Vietnam, the local correspondent in Hong Kong was instructed to call her and tell her that I'd been shot. And he had a bit of a stutter, and he was very nervous that my wife might get hysterical. And so he said, my wife put him out of his misery and said, look, you're calling to tell me my husband's been wounded but not killed. And he said, yes, how did you know? And she said, well, if he'd been killed, your instructions were to come to the door. You wouldn't have called on the telephone. But if he's just wounded and not been killed, it would be okay to telephone. So that's the message, isn't it? So...
yeah, pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yes.
My guest is David Greenway. He is a longtime foreign correspondent for many, many major news organizations. His new book is called Foreign Correspondent, a Memoir. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest is David Greenway, veteran journalist, longtime foreign correspondent for many national publications, and author of a new book called Foreign Correspondent, a Memoir. If you have a question or comment for David, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to go back to that issue about how your thoughts changed about the Vietnam War once you were covering it, and the idea of maintaining your objectivity in reporting on a war. The more you get to know about the war when you're covering it, how do you maintain your objectivity?
Well, you try your best.
Mm-hmm.
And if at least you try to be fair, if objectivity is... But it's a difficult word to define.
Mm-hmm.
You just try to give both sides of the story if you can. Some stories you can do that. For example, when the Israelis were besieging Beirut back in the 80s, you could sit up on the hill and watch the Israeli gunners shelling the town. And then you could go back through the lines and into the town and go and interview the people who were being shelled. And so you got a complete view. But most wars, you can't do that. You just cover one side. So in that sense, if you can't talk to the other side, objectivity is somewhat limited. But you try your best.
How do you think you've covered wars for most of your career. I guess I was wondering how you think, do you think of it as covering wars or conflicts or the world? How do you think of it?
I think it more of covering the world. Mm-hmm. And where there's conflict, it's always more dramatic. But, you know, I've done a lot of interviews in Canada, and thank goodness there haven't been any wars in Canada since the last time we attacked them.
You wrote that as an undergrad at Yale University, the history of art and architecture courses made a big impression on you and how you viewed the world around you, and I wondered how you think they might have affected your reporting in other countries.
Well, I think that it helped me to keep my eyes open for the cultural differences. And a lot of cultural differences can be seen in art, and especially architecture. And you get to appreciate that and what it means to the people. A mosque is very different than a church, and no less beautiful. And so you begin to look into, you know, what Muslims believe and what they think and what the importance is. So I think that was the long-lasting effect.
Does covering war depress journalists? Has there been any kind of depression? It seems like it would be very sad. I would be very sad. I mean, I get sad just thinking about the firebombing of Dresden still, let alone the devastation to all these incredibly old places that's occurring right now.
Reporters aren't immune from stress and the effects that that can have. And I knew quite a few reporters that you would now say had post-stress syndrome, but no one called it that then. But yeah, I think that they have an effect. You see things all smashed up and people smashed up, and it has to have an effect on you.
So how do you manage that? Do you look for that in your colleagues? Do you watch each other? How do you keep track?
Well, I would say there's too little of that.
Okay.
I would hope there'd be more but there is a certain amount when you notice that somebody is reacting strangely and reacting badly to stress, you try to talk to them and see if you can help them in any way.
Do you think this is another point of contact with a larger organization that makes it helpful? In other words, when you report for the New York Times, are they sensitive to that?
Oh, yes, I think they are. And when I was a foreign editor at the Boston Globe, I once thought I noticed this in one of my correspondents overseas. And without making a fuss, I reassigned him to a less stressful assignment because I thought I saw these symptoms.
Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air with David Greenway. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. It's said that the first casualty of war is the truth. And how do we get at that truth when governments, including our own and other parties involved in conflict, are so actively involved in suppressing that truth?
Well, I did notice in many of the conflicts that I have covered, and specifically in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, there was a certain thread. And it wasn't so much that the officials were trying to suppress the truth or lie to you. Sebastian Junger, a wonderful writer, put it this way in Afghanistan, but I think it's certainly true, and it was true in Vietnam and was true in Iraq as well, that they weren't lying to you. They were inviting you to join a conspiracy of wishful thinking. And I think so often these are well-meaning people who want to succeed, want the mission to succeed, and but get carried away with wishful thinking. And I think that's I think that's probably prevalent in every war.
When you were covering Vietnam, were you escorted most of the time by U.S. troops?
Well, you were, in that sense, yes. We were, they call it now, embedded.
Yes.
Yeah, we would go out and go along with U.S. troops. And you'd, you know, sleep on the ground and eat the same rations they did and spend some time with them. And often there were firefights that you had to experience with them. So, but you always knew with American troops that if you were hurt, you'd get the best medical help that was available. When you went with South Vietnamese troops, it wasn't because they didn't want to help you. They didn't have the best equipment. And that was doubly true for Cambodian troops. So, yeah, if you had Americans, you knew you were going to have the best medical help if you were shot.
Did you always feel like the Americans had your back, that they'd give you the best medical help? But what, when you're embedded with troops, what has been the nature of your relationship with them?
Well, at first they're startled, and they don't know what you're doing here. And their first question is, you mean you don't have to be here? And you have to confess that you don't have to be there. And then they said, you're not carrying a weapon? And no, we didn't carry weapons. But then once you got to know them and talk to them, they liked to tell their stories. And they liked the idea that their stories might get out and into papers around the world. So I always had quite a good relationship with soldiers in the field.
Sebastian Junger, you mentioned him. He did an incredible job with the film Restrepo.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I interviewed him at the time that the film came out, and there was a relationship, but they also managed to keep separate from them emotionally. They had to, he said.
Well, I expect that's true. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Because it's the same reason. How do you keep that objectivity about people? You don't want anybody to get hurt. But there you are. Now, you said that you weren't armed. Were you talking about Vietnam? Are you never armed?
Never. Well, one time I was. But that's because the soldiers I was traveling with in that circumstances wanted me to be. But no, I never carried weapon. It just gets you into more trouble than it'll get you out of.
Is that typical of journalists?
Yes. You can't be really. If you're a non-combatant reporter, you can't go around carrying weapons. And if you're carrying weapons, you've got to be prepared to use them. And we all learned in many different languages how to say, "I'm a reporter," if you were captured.
Mm-hmm. And does that help or hurt?
Well, I think in those days it might have helped. Mm-hmm. These days, no. I think reporters are being targeted. So in that sense, this conflict in Syria and Iraq is more dangerous.
What do you make of the targeting of journalists? When I spoke with the New York Times reporter, she says it's definitely affected the ranks of reporters that are covering the conflict over there. What do you make of that now, and what kind of an impact do you think it has on the reporting and what we really are learning about?
Well, naturally, I deplore it. Mm-hmm. But I think it hasn't stopped the news from getting out. Your last guest proves the point. She knew all the dangers and everything, but she was reporting from all these dangerous places and came back to tell you about it.
You were injured by a bomb in Vietnam. I thought it was a bomb. You said you were shot.
Well, it was a rocket-propelled grenade, which is like a hand grenade that's fired out of a rocket, and a piece of that hit me.
Tell us what happened when that occurred.
Well, I was covering a Marine assault in the city of Hue in Vietnam during something called the Tet Offensive, which was a big surprise to all the Americans and South Vietnamese, and largely turned America against the war. But anyway,
it was during a national holiday, right? The Tet.
Yes, the Tet is their Lunar New Year mm-hmm. in Vietnam, sort of like Chinese New Year,
right.
And everyone goes on vacation, and the Vietnamese communists cleverly attacked at that moment, knowing the guard would be down. But anyway, this Marine in front of me was shot in the throat, and the corpsman, the Navy corpsman who was the medic for the Marines, was having trouble carrying him. So I got up from where I was crouching on the ground and helped him carry the fellow back in the rear, and some other reporters helped. And then this rocket-propelled grenade came in, and I was wounded, and another fellow was wounded. And it may have killed the guy we were trying to carry out.
What did it do to you?
Oh, it just hit me in the leg. It wasn't serious. I was taken back to a hospital in the rear, given very good treatment, and operated on, and by a very cross American doctor who felt that it was unfair that his instructions were to take care of the Americans before the Vietnamese soldiers. We were all lying out in the rain for a while before our time for surgery came up. And I don't blame him. It was shocking.
Take care of the Americans before the Vietnamese, even if they didn't triage, in other words.
Well, there were Vietnamese soldiers with us.
I see.
On our
okay.
side.
Gotcha.
And they were brought back to the same hospital, but they weren't treated equally with us. The Americans got treated first, and the South Vietnamese soldiers got treated second. And this doctor was extremely upset with that.
We have an email from Gina. She writes, I wonder if David Greenway thinks that the U.S. could reduce the risk of war by funding more journalists to just report on the culture issues of many, many foreign countries which are not currently at war. It seems that modern technology might facilitate this. If we knew more about other cultures, would that help?
I don't think it's going to prevent war, but I certainly think that the more reporting we could do about other cultures and the more we understand, we won't stumble into mistakes. I'm haunted by Robert McNamara, Kennedy and Johnson's Secretary of Defense, who was a high architect of the Vietnam War, who, after the war was over, admitted that he was wrong, that the war was wrong, that he didn't know anything about the culture or the history of Vietnam, and that it was a mistake. Well, one can't help thinking if more people in the Kennedy and Johnson administration had understood the culture of history of Vietnam, they might have come to a different policy.
Are there any other parallels in your experience covering wars that reflect that same
problem?
Well, yes.
I found that people in Baghdad, Americans in Baghdad, had very little knowledge of the Arab world. Some of them, I think even in the highest reaches of government, didn't know anything about Shiites and Sunnis and this great split that has its parallel between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland. And maybe if we'd known more, we would have done differently.
David Greenway, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
David Greenway, he's the author of Foreign Correspondent, a Memoir. Thanks to everybody on the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Jolie Friedman, and Muya Shen, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Thanks to you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.